Ian Whitcomb came of age in England in the 1940s. Early on, he developed a lifelong obsession with American popular music from the turn of the century to the dawn of rock and roll. He sings pop songs and writes books about pop music, including After the Ball and a new book titled Irving Berlin and Ragtime America. When he first came to America in the 60s, he had a fluke novelty hit, but most of his own songs are inspired by his beloved tunesmiths of Tin Pan Alley.
Cows and sheep and horses, meals with seven courses, down on the farm, peaceful and calm. Cock crow wakes me at a quarter to five. Morning breeze don't make me shudder, get my milk straight from the udder. And when they saw...
Was American music ever considered a bad influence when you were growing up?
Oh, it certainly was. It certainly was at the rather expensive prep school that I was sent to improve me. The vice headmaster of the school, and he was vice in all senses of the word, he had a collection of records, Gilbert and Sullivan and so forth, and he was called Captain. He's dead now, so we can talk about Captain Manning. And he had Gilbert and Sullivan, but he had a little bit of this American stuff, and he had some Sophie Tucker, and he also, which I liked. And the other record, though, that I liked, and it was being played on the BBC at that time, which he didn't like, was Kiss Me Big by Tennessee Ernie Ford. It had these lines, kiss me big, make me know it. When I've been kissed, I want to show it. When our lips meet just under my nose, don't turn me loose till it curls my toes. That's the kind of kissing I've been missing. Baby, won't you kiss me big? Well, the vice headmaster, he didn't mind songs about the American South in the 20s, but he did object to Kiss Me Big. So he said this was American decadence.
Well, because it had the word kiss in it? No, not because of kiss. Well, it implied sex.
These were pre-rock and roll records, but in all senses and sounds, they were rock and roll. I mean, they were about the same things. They were about sex, and they were set to a syncopated beat.
In one of your books, you wrote that to you, Americans were sex, next only to the French, of course. But did you think from listening to American music that the Americans were just oh so sexy?
Growing up in England in the 1940s, which, as you know, is the age of austerity after World War II, we apparently won it, but in all other senses, we lost it, you see, because we didn't have any candy there. We couldn't get blue jeans. So Americans had blue jeans. American soldiers seemed to be better built. We had American movies in Technicolor, and they always seemed to show extremely well-upholstered American boys and girls, and they seemed to be fed on ice-cold milk.
How did you finally get to go to America, and how old were you the first time you came?
Let me see. I was, I think, 20... Yeah, must have been 21, 21, 22. It was 1963. I'll never forget that year.
But here's the irony. Here's the irony. You, the British boy, growing up loving America, finally get to America just in time for the British invasion, so that all the young people in America are obsessed with England when you get here.
Irony, yes, that I would use a stronger word than that. It was bloody hell. It was one of the most annoying... Terry, it was one of the most annoying things in my life, and it probably has embittered me. I mean, there are a lot of people in rock and roll who perhaps remember... Well, they certainly remember me, and they see me as this dreadful gadfly, this fellow who keeps knocking the British groups.
But you could have really, and I think in a way you did really exploit being British, knowing that it could really... go over in America.
Well, you think so? Oh, well, I mean, I didn't in terms of rock and roll, because the one big hit that I had, You Turn Me On, had nothing to do with the British invasion in terms of its sound. I mean, many people in Britain thought I was American or Irish, you see.
The first hit that you had, hit that made the charts was...
No, Terry, no, I must get this...
Was Nervous on the charts too?
No, they were all... No.
They were all on the charts.
No, Sporting Life, this Sporting Life was on the charts. It reached 99.
Ah. Never,
well, that was the first sort of minor hit.
How did you write You Turn Me On?
Well, what happened was I didn't really write the song. What happened was that in 1964, when I was in America, I was in a couch late at night in Seattle somewhere, and this young girl said, Ian, I love your accent. You're really turning me on. And I thought, what a phrase. You turn on a tap, you turn on other things, you turn on a light, you don't turn somebody on. So I kept the phrase in my mind, went back to Trinity College Dublin and put it into a sort of 12-bar blues thing.
Come on now.
Come on.
what did you have to do to promote the record? Did you do anything? I think promoting novelty records, and that was really a novelty record, is probably different than, say, promoting a ballad or you know.
Terry, I didn't promote it. I tried to stop it. That is absolutely
You really did. Okay.
That's absolutely true. I tried to stop the record. I thought it was so disgusting. You see, I wanted to come out with a follow-up to Sporting Life. I wanted to have I had a protest song about No Tears for Johnny. It was an anti-war song. I wanted to be the next Joan Baez. And instead, this bloody record company, actually, to be exact, it was Tower Records, a subsidiary of Capitol. They said, oh, no, man, this is a Stone Fox smash. Don't knock success. I said, but this is going to ruin me culturally. And indeed it has.
Oh, God, I love it. I can't see you as the next Joan Baez, but we'll let that go.
No, well, you know, I tried my best.
Well, once you were no longer on the charts, and it was a pretty short time that you were, is that when you really started seriously turning to Tin Pan Alley?
Well, I'd always liked to muse old songs, and I started researching. By that time, I discovered the real ragtime Scott Joplin, and then I started getting, you know, because I'm really a novelty man, I began to sing the old songs. And so, yes, I found myself washed up in the late 60s, totally irrelevant in this new, brave, new world. And so I went back into the past, and I've stayed there. And I wrote a book, because I couldn't get any other work. It's as simple as that. But now I'm proudest of my books.
You've just completed a book about Irving Berlin. Why did you want to write a book about him?
Well, because I centered in on him as the man who was the beginning and perhaps the end of the sort of pop that I like. I mean, he really did start modern American popular song. There was only one man before him, Stephen Foster. He didn't get organized.
Has living in America given you a different perspective on American Tin Pan Alley?
Yes, I admire it even more. You see, I see this spirit, this American spirit. Sometimes I get misunderstood. Sometimes people here say, how dare you come here, an Englishman, and a failure at that, and tell us about ourselves in such rude terms. But of course, I mean this as a compliment. I love this wonderful Mark Twainian, Mark Twain was the first to talk about this mixture of art and commerce, and they are quintessentially American, and Americans are always on the move. They're always and they've got tremendous hope, and they have ideals, and they love making money too, and they have wonderful open hearts too. And it's so, you know, you only have to go to Britain today or the rest of the world to see that this doesn't exist anywhere else. So I've always said, God bless America.
That's a name of a song.
Well, that was Berlin's song, which he wrote, by the way, for his big soldier show, Yip Yip Yap Hank, in World War One. You know, that song was canned from the show in World War One in 1918, because they said, Irving, you've gone over the top here. I mean, no, that's too much. God bless America. How can you say that? So he put it away. And then Kate Smith rediscovered it in the 1930s. And the rest is history.
Well, Ian Whitcomb, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, thank you very much for putting up with me.
Ian,
and America. Thank you, America.
Ian, that was fun.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Ian Whitcomb enjoys digging up and recording lesser-known Irving Berlin songs. Here's Ian singing When the Folks High Up Do the Mean Low Down.
Whenever the folks high up do the mean low down, there ain't no low down lower than that. Whenever the swells low down and go low down, there ain't no low down lower than that. You may believe it or not, when they start getting hot, there is no hottentot that's hotter than that. So you can lay yo down down when they go low down. There ain't no low down lower than that.
This is Fresh Air.